Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
And welcome to the Vocalfies podcast, a podcast about linguistic discrimination.
Hi, I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And today we are talking about grammar. We're talking about the grammar snobs among us.
Right. What we used to call grammar Nazis, but it seems unfair to call them that now.
It does. And I've always wondered why you would want to be called that anyway. But, you know.
Well, I don't think it was self-applied at first. But still, a little unfair.
Some people were totally, like, proud of that.
Yes.
Like, I remember the days where Facebook, you could have, like, little bios. People would put grammar Nazi, like, put things about themselves, like, that to describe themselves.
That's true.
Yeah.
They adopted it.
Yeah. Yeah, like a badge of honor.
Yeah, I wonder how many people still use that now.
I know. Real Nazis have kind of ruined it.
Yikes.
Just like everything.
Just like everything.
Yes. Okay, so I wonder how many people are already upset. Do you think there are people that are already upset?
Probably. This one is probably going to piss off the most people because we're all trained to be grammar snobs. We're trained mm-hmm. to judge people for the way that they write and speak. And so... Mm-hmm. We're going to try and undo that, and it's going to upset people. I know that.
It is. But I really think that if anyone can undo it, it's two women. Us, like, specifically us two women. So.
Yeah, there's no problem with that whatsoever.
Okay, we're going to start, like, a corrections corner now.
Yeah, we have a corrections corner.
Yeah, listen. We fucked up.
So the first thing I want to talk about is, I don't even remember who it was, but someone tweeted at me and another, at us and another podcast about how saying that vagina literally means sword sheath is an etymological fallacy, which is absolutely correct. What mm-hmm. I should have said is literally in Latin. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with how speakers of English think about the word.
Right.
But I just wanted to give people an excuse to not feel like they had to use vagina because mm-hmm. nobody likes that word. And I don't think it's only because of what it describes. Like, yeah, people get squicked out about female genitalia, but I think it's also just not an attractive word. I don't know. So
no.
It was just an excuse to be like, hey.
Right. And I mean, this actually might just all be Oprah's fault. Like, when she first said vajayjay, we were just like, well, we gotta get rid of vagina now. Because of Oprah, so. But anyway, yes.
I want to blame Oprah, but I don't think so. I think it was already disliked before that.
Okay. And we got our first email.
Yay!
Do you want to read it, Gary?
All right, so this is from Chris. I don't know if we want to use last names, so I'm just going to say Chris.
Yeah.
Hi, I just started listening after the podcast was recommended on the Lingthusiasm Twitter feed. And this is just me. Thanks, Lingthusiasm.
Yeah, shout out Lingthusiasm with Lauren and Gretchen. Thank you.
back to the email. Really enjoyed the first two episodes. I just wanted to add/clarify some stuff you mentioned in episode 2 about swearing in British English. The first thing was that you said cunt in British English is not a particularly strong word. This is true for some Brits, but it's really strongly region dependent. So in Cockney, it's as you said, and in Glaswegian, it's entirely unremarkable. That's where some of my relatives come from, by the way. And probably other places too. But in other areas, I'm from Liverpool. This is certainly true there and through the rest of Northwest England. I also think much wider than that, but I'm less confident about areas further from home. It's quite possibly the strongest word in the English language other than ethnic slurs. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear about how strong I mean, I'm not at all timid with swearing, but not only do I almost never use that word, I feel kind of uncomfortable even saying it when quoting someone. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was about bloody. You seem kind of unsure how strong a word that is. So to answer that, it is the absolute lowest level of swearing, to the point I'm really unsure if I want to use the word swearing or not. Like, you wouldn't hear it on a kid's TV show, but as you said on the pod, it is used in Harry Potter fairly regularly. I'd compare it to damn, but then I think that's stronger in the US than in the UK. It's really not much stronger than something like flipping. And then I thought this was so sweet. Mm-hmm. I really hope this comes across as the helpful clarification, since you seemed unsure about stuff, that it's intended as, rather than some guy being a dick about you not being experts on British swearing. Greetings from a Brit in Germany, and keep up the good work on the pod. So thank you so much, Chris. That was very sweet.
Yes. Also, that's the opposite of mansplaining. I just love it.
Yes.
Like, that's how you do it.
Yes. And I really did not know about the regionality at all. I was more confident mm-hmm. about bloody than I probably came across, but I really did not know. So that's awesome. Thank you so much for that information.
Yeah. And I also wonder if he's just really uncomfortable using cunt because he's a man.
But it's not... True. That's not uncomfortable for, say, Glaswegians, as he was saying.
Oh, right. Good point. Yes.
If you watch Trainspotting.
Oh, my God. Is that
I think that's actually Edinburgh, right? They don't have any problem saying it in that.
I'm not a type of cunt that goes looking for fucking bother, like, but at the end of the day, I'm a cunt with a pool cue and he could have a fat end in his puss anytime he fucking wanted, like.
Oh, okay. All right. You're right. They do not have Awesome. Okay. Well, Chris is currently my favorite podcast fan. So
fan of the pod.
Thanks, Chris. Okay. There was another thing that you wanted to talk about at the beginning of the podcast, right? Before we got into it.
Yeah. This is not actually a correction. This is just a explanation. So my cousin Murray wanted to know why some people pronounce street. I mean, I don't know if that's going to come across very well. Street. So like a sh instead of a s. And this is actually a phenomenon called assimilation, where sounds become more like other sounds. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of unusual because they're separated by another sound in the middle. So the S is becoming more like the R. So the R is pronounced slightly further back in the mouth than the S, and then the sh is closer to the R. So it's a kind of assimilation. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm hoping that's helpful to my cousin. And if you don't know, now
you know. Okay, awesome. Now into it. Should we get into grammar snobbery?
Yes.
All right. I feel like this is kind of like this is the fourth episode we're doing, and I feel like we're late to the game when it comes to all other linguists when talking about prescriptivism versus descriptivism. Mostly linguists have already mentioned this, like, once if you're talking to a linguist, we usually mention this within the first 2.5 minutes you're talking to us, so
absolutely
right. It's like
it's Ling 101 first day class,
right? Anyway, we should probably say what it is.
Yes.
Do you want
to? Sure. So there's a difference between prescriptive grammar versus descriptive grammar. Linguists are describers. We look at what's actually out in the real world and we describe that. And then we also try to explain it. But we look at the real world. Prescriptivists want the world to be in a particular way. So they want people to speak and write in a particular way. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to, this is like centuries ago, so, different white men, depending on the era, were trying to make English seem more like Latin. Because in their mind, Latin was unchanged and this perfect language. Mm-hmm. Of course, it changed because it was a spoken language. And where does French and Spanish and all those other languages come from other than Latin changing? But even Latin proper, there are different varieties of it. So it's completely insane on its face. But anyway, so prescriptivists are trying to, they're idealists, I guess, whereas linguists or descriptivists are realists.
Right. And when we're trying to explain what we see, we do it without judgment. And I think that that's important. Right. Because that's what this whole podcast is about. And that's what we're trying to advocate for. Don't be an asshole. Don't judge. Right. Observe. Even hopefully one day y'all get to like the point where you appreciate these differences. If you're not already there. But yeah. Okay, so
why are we talking about prescriptivism? Besides the fact that all linguists do.
Yeah. Well, it's where most of linguistic discrimination is upheld. And I feel like this is like going to be the final frontier. Like once everyone's on board with you know, like Southern English, like we talked about last week, realizing that that has nothing to do with, you know, it doesn't correlate with racism or how smart you are using Southern American English. I feel like once everyone's on board with that kind of stuff, they're still going to be holding on to the idea that we should have proper grammar. Like, I think this is going to be the last one that sticks around. And it's because it's so embedded. It's so embedded. We go to school, we go through K through 12, at least in the United States, and we're taught that there's one way to speak.
Yep.
In most school systems, that's what they teach us. And I think both of us used to fight against this, right?
Yes. Yeah, I used to fight in the classroom, and there's always at least one student who just would never budge the whole term.
Right. And so you were technically in the English department. I graduated from the English department. I technically have a master's degree in English. Okay. So I can say this with certainty that being an English major doesn't mean you have to be an asshole about grammar. You know?
Right. It really doesn't. And yet it's really inculcated in people. It's really hard to fight.
It is.
But now that I'm not in the classroom anymore, I felt like I really need to fight it in the real world and explain to people that this is not okay. Because what we're doing when we're being prescriptivists is we're really being racist and classist.
And ableist is something
ableist.
That, yeah. And we're going to talk more about why that's the case.
Right.
Yes.
And it's also just really damaging to people. People feel bad about themselves because they think that they can't speak properly, that they're not good English speakers. When they're just as good as anybody else, they just speak a different variety.
Right. Yeah, I saw this. It was really hard for me as a linguist. I needed money, so I taught at a local community college, which I actually loved, but I was teaching grammar. And that's really hard to do when you're like, well, I don't want to feel like I'm prescribing how these people should speak. So I started the class with, listen, the way that you talk right now, the way that you write right now, the way that you text, the way that you talk to your friends is perfect. That's totally, like, I'm not trying to change the way you do those things. I'm just going to try to add to your repertoire by giving you these tools to, you know, we live in a system where we need to be able to write sometimes in this particular way.
Yeah.
It actually opens the doors to students appreciating or coming up to you and appreciating you more because they're like, oh, it's really nice that someone's not trying to change me.
Right. It's just an extra skill. It's not replacing anything, like you said.
Right. And someone actually asked me, like, so does that mean it's okay that I say y'all? And I was like, oh.
Of course.
Yes. Oh, my God. I didn't even know that y'all was a thing that people – but I think maybe because it was associated – maybe it's because it's associated with Southern American English or maybe African American English, which are marginalized for, you know, reasons we've talked about that they –
Yes, that's
– they've got that message, but
– Yeah, that's exactly why. But it's still very strange because – not everybody. A lot of people say y'all, and it just doesn't feel like anything you should be judging. But of course, people are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now that we've talked about why, let's talk about what some of these prescriptive rules are. And again, they're made up. They're made up rules.
Yeah.
Somebody just decided one day, aha, I'm gonna make this a rule. And then for some reason, people stuck with it.
Patriarchy. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's just one dude, and it's always just one dude at first.
I know, but then it's like the people empowered that like keep perpetuating those rules, and unfortunately people in power have been white dudes, so
also because English was originally spoken mostly by white people, so that part
true.
But anyway, so one of the examples is the ban on double negatives, and we talked about this in the last episode, in episode 3. So if you really want to know why we think this is a ridiculous rule, you can go back to that episode. I just wanted to give a little bit of background. So in 1762, Bishop Robert Loth, I think that's how you pronounce his name, wrote a short introduction to English grammar with critical notes, and that seems to be where this rule comes from. So it's just some dude writing it down. Okay, he was a bishop, so I guess he's not just some dude. But one person just decides, okay, this is a rule, I'm going to write it down. And it's still around. We still obey this.
That is so frustrating. Oh, well, Robert Loth is on my shit list. Another rule that we love, well, me and you love to hate, ban on ending a sentence in a preposition. This is just bonkers.
Agreed. Yeah, my favorite quote, which is often misattributed to Winston Churchill, is, I don't remember the whole sentence, but basically, this is something up with which I will not put. And it's trying to like show like how horrible it is to have a ban on ending a sentence with a preposition. Mm-hmm. Now, it's kind of a cheating sentence because nobody suggests that the preposition that goes with the verb in a phrasal verb should somehow float further into the front of the sentence. So it should be, this is a rule with which I will not put up. Mm. Even that sounds bad, though. Mm-hmm. Most people would normally say, I will not put up with that. No, this is a rule I will not put up with. Mm-hmm. That sounds the best. That sounds the most fluid. But anyway, so it's kind of a cheating sentence because you're doing something that nobody says you should do. So you're allowed to end sentences and prepositions as long as they're prepositions that are part of a phrasal verb.
Mm-hmm. We don't think like this when we're speaking, you know?
Right,
That's some, like, mental gymnastics for me.
Right.
To be like, oh, I just ended that sentence with a preposition. Like, when I'm writing, I'll notice that I put a period and it's next to a preposition. And if I'm writing a scientific paper, I'll go and fix it because that's what the rules tell me I need to do to get published or whatever. But I certainly am not going to go back and fix it when I'm speaking.
Right. No. Yeah. Nobody. Well, I shouldn't say nobody. Fewer people do this in speech than in writing because you're not going to be attacked for violating this particular rule when you're speaking. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's still completely manufactured, and apparently it was created in 1672 by the essayist John Dryden.
Ah, another white guy to add to my shit list. I'm guessing he's white.
And I really feel like when you don't end a sentence in a preposition, when it really should, you should, but that's just the most fluid way to say it. It just sounds really stilted.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And again, this is to make English behave more like other languages as opposed to just accepting English as it is. So, for example, French, most dialects of French, you cannot end a sentence in a preposition. French does not have these phrasal verbs like English does, so we don't have that issue. But anyway, English is not French, and we shouldn't force languages to be like each other.
Right. Okay, and another big one that grammar snobs like to say is that ain't a word. So I ain't gonna use it, right? That was the thing I remember hearing growing up. Mm-hmm. And I totally bought into it.
Yeah, I think I did too. I was quite the snob when I was growing up. But words are words because we use them. They just are. Like, if you have a community using a word, it becomes a word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some people will say, well, now we can use it because ain't is in the dictionary. But again, like, that's true that it's in the dictionary, but dictionaries are changing just like language is changing. But it's a little bit slower because, mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know.
Because the communities have to be using the words first, and then the dictionary describes what's being used.
Exactly.
So there's always going to be a lag.
Right. And I like to say, relatedly, that slang words and texting language is not destroying language or fucking up English grammar. It might be changing English grammar. We have yet to see, because these things evolve over time, right? But if it is, like, it doesn't fucking matter. That's just right. How it works.
Language changes no matter what. In fact, English would be changing faster if we weren't literate, because the literacy wouldn't be slowing us down. So we have these rules for written English that make us speak in a particular way to keep certain words around. It's not destroying language, it's just changing.
Right.
Another rule that we see is you have to use past tense forms, past tense and perfect forms, and for past perfect, like, I have seen it would be the perfect, and I saw it would be the past. But we hear people say things like, I seen it, all the time. And I've really noticed that this is happening across the board. Like, all the verbs are fluctuating between past and perfect. So see seen, or I can't think of another one right now. Can you?
Wrote written.
Sorry. Yeah. I written it. I don't know if I've heard. No. I don't think I've heard that one. Anyway, so we have these conflations happening, and again, this is kind of a normal change. It happened in Latin, where the past tense and the perfect reduced to one form. So this is just something that happens in language. And if you think Latin is perfect, then maybe you should be okay with this. Oh,
also, who thinks Latin is perfect besides, like, classic majors?
I don't know.
Is that a thing?
Apparently it's a thing. I don't, or it was.
Yeah.
Or it was.
It was a thing. Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's fine. It's a language. It's cool. But all languages are fine and cool.
I save Latin. What did you ever do?
Yeah, exactly.
And I found this, this is modernized version of Chaucer from Troilus and Cressida, but he actually points out that language changes, and I think this is really nice. So, You know that even forms of speech can change within 1,000 years, and words we know were useful once seem to us wondrous strange, foolish or forced, and yet men spoke them so, and they spoke of love as well as men do now.
Oh, that's really nice.
Right? That's from 1385. So Chaucer knew what he was talking about centuries ago, and we still have to fight this fight.
Wow. Oh, I'm going to get that tattooed on my forehead. Okay.
That's a lot of text.
It is. My forehead's not that large. Okay, another thing that if you're a grammar snob, which, again, I'd like to say that I used to be one, so... whoever I'm calling a grammar snob right now, I was one of you. another thing grammar snobs might judge are typos.
Yeah.
And spelling in general, but typos.
Yeah. Typos happen. We all make them. Even if you're a really good speller, you're going to make a typo at some point in your life. Just let it go. Just let it go if someone makes a typo. And if you're fighting with someone online and your attack is, haha, you're stupid, you spelled your wrong, you've lost, because you're attacking the spelling,
right,
not the argument. It's almost like an ad hominem, except that it's not. You're not attacking the man, you're attacking the spelling, which is irrelevant.
No, it's so frustrating to me, because a lot of the people I follow on Twitter are have really good arguments, but they have a lot of trolls. And they'll often retweet a troll that has spelled something wrong or has used, quote, improper grammar. And then I'm like, no, all of your arguments are so good. Why are you dragging this into it?
Yeah, because they don't know that it's just as bad. Because we've just told everybody over and over and over again that it's okay to judge people for the way that they spell or write or speak.
Ugh. I would just like to make a confession right now that I used to spell ludicrous the way the rapper does.
That's awesome. I love that.
and literally, it may have come up. Okay, so like this was before spell check, obviously. It may never have come up before spell check if it weren't for AOL Instant Messenger when one of my friends like totally called me out on it, who, you know, like a friend who would like consider themselves a grammar snob, I'm sure. But they were really mean about it. And I was like, you know.
Yeah, this is the thing. It brings out people's meanness. I remember one time I used the word nauseous to mean nauseated. I still use nauseous to mean nauseated.
Yeah, me too.
And she was so mean about it. Like, oh my God, you're a linguist and you still say that? And I was just like, yeah, because I'm a linguist. I know what words are you supposed to use, quote unquote. But that's how we use it in English. Nauseous means nauseated, and it has for a long time now.
Yeah. Well, I have the thing where I'm always called out for saying less instead of fewer.
Yeah. It took me a long time. I was probably in my mid-20s before I even realized what the difference was. That's how useless that distinction is.
Yeah, it is. I know.
I've switched now, though. Now I use fewer, but...
I never will. I'm gonna die on this hill.
Good. You should. Oh, and one more thing about typos is there's also a law called Murphy's Law, as in Murphy's Law, but
I love it.
Switched the PH with the R. Murphy's Law. So if you call someone out for a typo or grammar mistake, chances are you're going to make a mistake in your response. That's favorite law.
That's amazing. I also want to say one more thing about spelling and writing in general is that writing is artificial.
Right.
We all learn spoken language and it's fine. But writing is artificial and we must be taught it. We must practice it, right? We don't have to practice our native language. And English spelling in particular is hard to conquer because just like many of our ancestors, English pillaged and plundered and took a lot of words from other languages. And I joke about that, but I actually like this about English. We have so many words from so many different languages.
Well, some of that is because we were pillaged. Well, the English were pillaged by the French.
And that's by the French. Yeah, by the French.
And the Vikings.
Yeah.
So it's not only the conquerors, but also the conquered. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Good point. It's a good point. No, but I really do like it about English that we have so many French words and Spanish, etc. But it makes it hard because we're taking words and we're taking their spelling, and maybe they make sense in the language that we took them from, but it's just lost in translation.
Yeah, sometimes it's because of that, but also even just English, the Anglo-Saxon words, we have such a horrible spelling system, like meat and meat.
Yeah.
They should be spelled the same. They're pronounced the same.
It's true. And then, but there's some words like knight that used to be pronounced knight. So, you know, like, oh, I didn't even know that. But the K made sense, right, at a certain point.
If you will not show us the grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
But anyway, spelling is hard. And
it doesn't have to be, but we've decided to continue with this horrendous system. Although the problem with reforming the English writing system, which I've said many times that we should do, the problem with it is then which dialect do you choose?
Yeah.
So it's not going to happen.
No. I'd also like to do a shout out right now to Spanish. Spanish has the greatest spelling system. It's just how it sounds. So good job.
Yeah, it's much more related to the sound. Yeah, much.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, the next one is splitting infinitives. So an infinitive is like to go, and if you split the infinitive, you get something like to boldly go.
Where no man has gone before.
Which sounds way better than not splitting it. So boldly to go, to go boldly, I mean, they're okay. It's not like they're as bad as like the not ending a sentence in a preposition examples. But again, it's a made-up rule. Basically, English has two words to create an infinitive, so to and go, or to and see. So of course you can split them because that's the property of words, is you can stick other words in between them. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this rule was really made up so that English would feel more like Latin. Latin infinitives are one word, so of course you can't split them because they're one word. Mm-hmm. And English didn't always have split infinitives, but in the 18th century, 19th century became pretty common. And there's an example from Robert Burns, or Robbie Burns, as I like to call him, who dared to nobly stem tyrannic pride. So this is like, you know, literary. It's got a very long tradition. And apparently, the earliest comment against split infinitives was by an anonymous American. America, fuck yeah! In 1834. Anyway, so he just was like, it sounds better if you keep the two with the verb, which is just weird and wrong. And I was in a dissertation defense many years ago now, before I finished my dissertation. And one of the committee members called my friend out for splitting an infinitive in his dissertation.
Oh my God.
This is supposed to be about the ideas in the thesis. Like, why did you say this about this? Or how do you explain this phenomenon given your analysis? And by the way, this was in a metals and materials engineering defense. What does split infinitives have to do with anything in that context? I was really mad. And if I had been finished my PhD, I might have actually said something to him, because mm-hmm. that was completely irrelevant.
Right.
Anyway.
Oh. Gosh. So the next one is a real famous one. It's, well, infamous. Who and whom? Mm-hmm. Right.
Every time I hear someone say whom, I want to slap them. It's so unfair.
I know. I'm like, who do you think is watching you right now? Who are you trying to impress?
Whom? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh my god. Well, you know what? As a linguist, a lot of people don't know what we do, right? So I feel like whenever I meet someone new, they are like, oh, don't correct my grammar. And this is one of the things where, like, they'll ask me, did I use whom correctly? And I'm like, oh, like, honestly, I don't fucking know. I wasn't paying attention.
I only notice if you use it incorrectly.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if someone uses it correctly, I might notice and I might just sort of like roll my eyes a little bit. But if you use it incorrectly, then I'm like, oh, this is like hyper correction. So if you said, whom are you?
Oh, yeah.
That would be really wrong. But I just don't like it. I don't like whom. I think we should just get rid of it. Nobody knows how to, I shouldn't say nobody. Lots of people do not know the rule, which tells you that it's not an important rule, so we should just let it go.
Right. It doesn't say anything about the people that don't know the rule. It says everything about how stupid the rule is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And then another one is the who that. So you're supposed to use who for human and that for non-human. So like, I saw the man who left versus I saw the cat that left. And I mean, I would never use who for an inanimate object. But other than that, I use who that interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And yes, in my writing, I will sometimes correct it because I know people will judge me for it. But it's mm-hmm. just the silliest rule.
It is. I feel the same way. I actually feel a little bit ashamed. Like, that's, I haven't shed that yet because I'm like, because people call me out on it. Like, I guess just I'm harboring some intense insecurities because I've been called out for using that with humans. It so doesn't matter.
People do it all the time. If you listen to people speak, they will say things like, I saw the man that left, all the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's fine to be like, okay, who is only for humans? Fine. If you want to make that rule, I could probably get on board with that part. But that just doesn't care.
Yeah. And also, you understand us when we say it. So, like,
right.
That's right. All that matters. It's all that matters.
Right. If you're critiquing something where you totally understand what the person has said, maybe you should rethink your critique. And because it really should be about the ideas, right? Really, so if you're should. Critiquing the idea, critique the idea.
Yes. Stop and ask yourself, am I being an asshole?
It just takes 2 seconds of your time.
It really does. So, should we talk about why you should fucking stop judging people for these things?
Yes. I mean, I think we've kind of scattered it throughout this, but it really is a shitty thing to do.
It really is. I mean, we could stop there, But why is it shitty?
Well, because you're attacking things that are relevant to the argument, as I said before.
Yeah.
Sneaky way to be racist or classist.
Or ableist. Yeah. So I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been working with kids and literacy and dyslexia and dysgraphia. I mean, these are legitimate reasons why people struggle with writing, with spelling, mm-hmm. right? And so it's ableist. It's this is a new thing for me, like literally in the last week. I was like, oh shit, this is ableist.
Right.
I'm still learning and growing, right?
Right, we all are.
Yeah, but for a while now, I've known it's racist and classist. And I think it's because, for me, I learned this the hard way. People are really proud of the fact that they're good at grammar, and I feel like I was one of those people that was really proud of that fact too, because I was like constantly praised for my writing and for my language. But then I realized it was at the fucking expense of the language of my parents. Like, my parents use double negatives. My parents, you know, like, say ain't, or there's these things that they do that would be judged as improper grammar. Mm-hmm. And I realized how unfair that was.
Yeah. So I grew up in a family that is basically very prescriptive. So it was in my house. It was at school. It wasn't until I got into linguistics that I realized just how horrible it is. Yeah, so that's the best thing about linguistics.
It really is.
It undoes at least some of your biases. Obviously, we still have biases because we're human beings, but it helps.
Yeah.
It helps a lot.
And I guess we should say why it's racist and classist.
Yes.
I mean, again, writing is artificial. If you don't know the difference between your, and your in writing, this may be because of the education system that you grew up in, the quality of it, how far you got in your education, mm-hmm. how many times you were made to practice this, right? Like, if you didn't go that far in your education system from one reason or another, and maybe that's because of socioeconomic reasons, so class, then you don't have time to practice this. And again, these are things that you practice and you learn. So that's one reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same thing for racism because, again, many of the schools in the United States in particular are separated racially. The same kind of arguments that you just made about class can apply there.
Yeah, and we have the thing where we haven't talked about African-American English or Chicano English yet, but these are varieties that do have things like double negatives.
Mm-hmm.
And if a child that grew up speaking African-American English decides to write something and they use double negatives, this is going to be so, like, perfectly grammatically correct in their grammar of African-American English.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the type of grammar that we, like, as a society have prescribed to be the correct one. So
right.
It's going to be incorrect in the eyes of a grammar snob.
Right.
Right.
And of course, there's also... There are many people who can switch back and forth between the quote-unquote correct English, basically the prescriptive English, and then their own variety. And then you might catch them using their own variety and then judge them for that, even though they can use both equally well.
Right.
So it's just bad.
And I think that just like a positive thing to say about that is I've seen video of K-12 classes where they're actually teaching kids to code switch now.
Right.
They're calling it code switching. And they're saying, just like I tried to do when I was teaching at community college, they said, this is the language you're bringing. Let's talk about your language or your dialect that you're bringing to the school. And then let's talk about code switching to this other one when we have, you know, when we're in a school setting or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, I mean, you should be able to use your variety whenever you want. But unfortunately, the world that we live in penalizes you.
Exactly.
So if you put, but if, so if you yeah. phrase it that way, kind of like you did with your community college class, if you phrase it that way,
yeah.
Hey, look, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but let's add to your skill set so that you can move in the world in a different way when you need to.
Yeah, and you're totally right. Like when I said code switch to the school set, like let's use this language in the school setting, it felt so wrong. Like my stomach kind of hurt because I was like, oh, there's so many fucked up reasons why so-called standard American English is the one that we use in a school setting. And that's problematic on so many reasons, so racist, so class, like so many terrible things intersect to make that the reason why that's the language you use in the school. But since we live in this fucked up society, you know,
yeah.
teach them this way of, if we teach people to code switch and we frame it as that in schools and tell them there's nothing wrong with the way that you're speaking. And maybe even explain that it's fucked up that this is the reason why.
Right.
I think we'd get a lot further with people.
Yes, we would. And also people could not feel superior anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. The opposite too, right? People won't feel so shitty about the way that they speak.
Right. Both are bad feelings and we should discourage both feelings.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we have any other issues we wanted to discuss?
No, I don't think so. I hope everyone enjoyed our first interview. And we have some exciting interviews coming up, but we'll pretend like we don't know what they are to keep you in suspense.
Also, we don't know exactly which order we're going to do them in. So. But yeah, I'm excited. I'm very excited for the next two that we have lined up.
Yeah.
And then we have others lined up for even later, too. Yeah. So it's getting
cool. It is getting exciting. And my partner asked me, is this sustainable? Like, are there that many topics? I'm like, listen. Yeah, Which, exactly. Please. Like, don't get me started. Like, wait until I have a microphone in front of me. Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I don't know. Were we angry this episode? I think we sound a little on edge. Was that? I don't know.
There was definitely not enough nerd rage. There should have been more nerd rage.
I kind of promised that on the Twitter account. But I think I cussed a little bit more on this one. So maybe that was what my rage manifests as.
Okay, good. That's good.
I don't raise my voice, so that's as far as I can get. Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess thanks for listening again, and don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole, and send all your hate mail to Carrie only. I'm just kidding. Bye. If you can't write in the proper way, if you don't know how to conjugate, maybe you flunked that class, and maybe now you find when people mock you on the The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by Chris Ayers for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com.